examples.
Given the events of today, the likelihood of impeachment, I'm not saying it's high necessarily, but it certainly went up.
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
The president is clearly guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. He should resign his office or be impeached.
Today, the Trump presidency took a giant step toward impeachment.
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 Impeachment implications are now in the air.
Impeachment.
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 If it is a crime, it certainly is an impeachable offense.
Impeach Trump.
Impeachment.
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 Impeachment is a word in play here in Washington today. The impeachment.
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 Impeachment here.
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
Should the president be impeached?
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
There are Democrats who say there's now more than enough to impeach.
Is itself an impeachable offense.
Consider something as serious as impeachment.
Impeachment.
The impeachment process.
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
The president will be removed from office after an impeachment trial.
On the impeachment issue.
Talk about impeachment.
Want to talk about impeachment.
Impeachment right now.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Willie's World. This is Willie in the flesh, or in the voice, I guess you would say, on radio. Today's podcast is episode number 32, The Deep State Echo Chamber. Impeach sotto voce. By sotto voce, I mean when you kind of whisper in somebody's ear so that only they can hear, because the Democratic Party at large doesn't want to say impeach. They just want to have it kind of spread around quietly, because it does sound a bit extreme, even though that's pretty much their agenda. Anyway, the whole Russia thing to me reminds me of the Seinfeld show, where they start out with Jerry and his buddy proposing a show to a network that's going to be about nothing. And everybody laughs, and well, the nothing show lasted about 11 years. And Russia is, when you come right down to it, it's about nothing except a story that was created for a diversion, but so far there's no there, there's nothing there. Anyway, I'd like to give a little summary of like where things are at and where things should move in the future in the next clip. And then after that, I want to talk about the echo chamber, what it is and how it works and how it worked for Ben Rhodes in the Obama administration. So up next is Jeanine Pirro subbing for Hannity and a panel of experts on what's going on and what's going to happen in the future.
Welcome to this special edition of Hannity, the left's agenda. I'm Jeanine Pirro, and tonight for Sean. For the hour, we'll show you how Democrats, the deep state, and the media are all working together against President Donald Trump. First, we'll address the special counsel's partisan probe into Russian collusion. While this administration pushes a sound conservative agenda, Mueller's witch hunt is dividing the country and wreaking political havoc day after day. Meanwhile, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is nowhere to be found. He's recused himself from all things Russia almost immediately after taking office. And now, the relationship between President Trump and his absentee Attorney General is at an all-time low. Today, the president mocks Sessions on Twitter, writing, quote, "Department of Justice will not be improperly influenced by political considerations. Jeff, this is great. What everyone wants. So look into all of the corruption on the other side, including deleted emails, Comey lies and leaks, Mueller conflicts, McCabe, Strzok, Page, Orr, FISA abuse, Christopher Steele, and his phony and corrupt dossier, the Clinton Foundation, illegal surveillance of Trump campaign, Russian collusion by Dems, and so much more. Open up the papers and documents without redaction. Come on, Jeff, you can do it. The country is waiting." Former House Oversight Committee Chairman Jason Chaffetz is slamming Sessions for perpetuating our two-tiered system of justice. Take a look.
Donald Trump is right and Jeff Sessions is wrong. Jeff Sessions, to say he hasn't done any political considerations is totally false. He hasn't done nothing to go after what Congress has been asking for and giving the documents up. He has done nothing to pursue what is known to be false statements to Congress. I was the chairman of the Oversight Committee and Bob Goodlatte, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. We sent a letter over to the Department of Justice asking him to look if Hillary Clinton lied under oath. Never gave a response. That's because of politics, not because he's just not doing his job.
Even Senator Lindsey Graham, a longtime Sessions ally, is questioning his ongoing tenure as Attorney General. Take a look.
Every president deserves an attorney general they have confidence in. As to Jeff Sessions, I've never met a finer man. He was a great senator. He's a great lawyer. I think he's been a good attorney general. But this is not working, so I hope the relationship gets better. If it doesn't, I would imagine the president is going to look for a new attorney general, because what's going on is unsustainable. I'm not blaming anybody. I love Jeff Sessions. But from my point of view, the country is not being well served with this much friction.
Meanwhile, with Sessions MIA, Mueller's partisan team of Democratic donors have aggressively targeted Trump and everyone around him. Clinton pollster Mark Penn is writing that Cohen's plea deal is merely an attempt to set up Trump. And the Wall Street Journal's Kimberly Strassel highlighted the FBI's one-sided investigation in a brand new report writing, quote, "The country has watched the FBI treat one presidential campaign with kid gloves, the other with informants, warrants, and eavesdropping." Joining us now to break all of this down is Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Russia Hoax, the illicit scheme to clear Hillary Clinton and frame Donald Trump, Fox News legal analyst Greg Jarrett, and former Clinton pollster and advisor Mark Penn. All right, good evening to all of you. I'm going to start with what Jason Chaffetz said that we just heard on that sound, where he talked about sending a letter to Jeff Sessions and saying he never got a response with respect to his investigation of all of the wrongdoings or apparent wrongdoings of the Clinton campaign. And I'll go to you, Attorney General Pam Bondi. Is Mueller's probe a one-sided probe?
Well, of course it is, because they're only looking at the president of the United States, and that is their target. And anyone who gets in the way is collateral damage. That's what they're doing. But all of these other issues have to be examined. I mean, we live in a nation of laws, and we have got to look at the Clinton emails, everything that you listed in your opening monologue, everything President Trump said. We've got to look at Strzok, Page, everything, the FISA warrant, everything. But especially these FBI agents who either, like Lisa Page, got to resign, or even the ones who were fired. I'm sorry, they don't get off that easy. They have to be investigated.
Well, they have to be investigated, but Greg, you and I both know that there is no attorney general who's interested in investigating him.
Jeff Sessions is either an unwitting dupe or he's incompetent. It's got to be one of the two. One of the fundamental principles of democracy is equal justice under the law. It's on the pediment of the U.S. Supreme Court. That's how important it is. But under Jeff Sessions and the previous Department of Justice, it is nothing more than a charade. The president rightly named more than a dozen things Sessions should be investigated for, especially Hillary Clinton and her conduct. James Comey twisted the facts, contorted the law to clear her. Both of them should be in front of a grand jury.
You said something interesting. You gave me two options. You said Jeff Sessions is either an unwitting dupe or incompetent.
Yes.
Or could it be possible that there are people who have convinced him that it's not in his interest to look at potential problems on the Democratic side?
That would go to incompetence, because if he's so...
That would go to being sold out. There's a difference between that as a prosecutor.
Yeah. That would be corrupt.
Right.
For political purposes, you are making decisions about law and justice, which are two polar opposites.
Okay, Mark Penn, I'll go to you on this. You know, your article that we'll get to in a little bit is excellent. I read it. But in terms of, you know, your being someone who worked with the Clintons, you know how they work. You know now that it appears or that there is a deep state here that is protecting them. Am I right in that assumption?
Well, I don't know whether it's a question of whether they're protecting Hillary Clinton or not, but they sure are going after President Trump.
No,
that's
no,
clear.
Let's back up. That's not the answer. What I'm looking for is if the woman had a foundation that was not investigated, no one has had, there is no kind of forensic accounting other than by people who are connected to the Clinton Foundation, that along with money going to the Fusion, and that's campaign funds being paid for a dossier that's totally fake, shouldn't she be looked at?
Well, look, every school child knows when you look at this that the most cursory tools and investigations were done on the allegations against the Clinton and the Clinton cash, and you're seeing the absolute entire state machinery of prosecutors, FBI, CIA, all combined going after Trump. So there's no question that there's an unequal scale here that almost everybody in America sees.
So then what do we do about it, Pam? I mean, you're an attorney general. How do you resolve this kind of thing?
Well, and again, we know we're not in a perfect world, but given all of our backgrounds, in a perfect world, what should be happening right now? Hillary Clinton should be in receipt of a target letter. Huma Abedin should be in receipt of a target letter. All of these people, and frankly, the American public shouldn't really know what's going on in a clean, honest investigation. So that's what should be going on. They should be under active investigation right now.
Yeah, but they're not.
The only way to do that is to replace Jeff Sessions. Look, when you have lost the confidence of your boss, the President of the United States, when you've breached that trust, the good and honorable and right thing to do is to submit your letter of resignation. And that's what Jeff Sessions should have done a long time ago. He apparently did it a year ago, but the president at the time felt it was unwise to accept it.
Well, that's President Trump. I mean, he gives everyone a chance. I mean, yeah, no, you can even look at the one who just wrote the book. Right. Gave her a chance, and, he believes in people. He believes in raising people up. But you know what? I'm going to go to you, Mark, on your article where you write about Cohen's plea deal is an attempt to set up Trump. All right, so we now know that Michael Cohen has pled guilty, and at the end of the plea, one of the last pleas, had to do with the reference to campaign finances. What was your take on that? How does it set up the president?
Look, I think, given what it seems the prosecutors found, probably Cohen would have pled guilty to the Lindbergh kidnapping had they asked him to. I think at the end of the day, they said, look, plead guilty to this. We'll reduce your sentence. We won't go after your wife. I think that was even now I understand on the table. And those things that he pled guilty to are not crimes. So by getting him to plead guilty, they can now create an unindicted conspiracy kind of theory for impeachment on something that's not a crime. This was established with Clinton. It was established with Edwards very clearly when even the FEC ruled that these payments were not campaign contributions. And frankly, had they paid them out of the campaign, they'd probably be indicted for misuse of campaign funds for personal purposes.
Well, there's no question about what Mark is saying, Pam, and that is that, you know, if you paid for it for personal purposes out of your own money, I mean, there's no campaign violation. Absolutely. They want to interpret it as meaning he was trying to meddle with the 2016 election. I find that stunning as a prosecutor.
Well, and we see it. We see CEOs. We see corporate executives all the time who men want to extort money from them. And they have, my advice is go to the police. But they never want to go to the police because they have families or it could affect their stocks. Right. So what they do is they hire a private attorney, and with that attorney, they do a lock solid non-disclosure. And that's a good attorney. This is a bad attorney who represented his client poorly.
Look at all the members of Congress who paid money to accusers sexual harassment and in exchange for NDAs. Now, obviously, it would benefit them in their re-election, but no prosecutor ever accused them of a campaign crime.
That's very interesting. Yeah, for all those people who paid off, you know, the young interns or whomever they sexually harassed with our taxpayers' money, I would remind you.
I talked to a career lawyer of the Department of Justice who has since left. He spent half of his time
on campaign violations. He said, this isn't a crime. It's not a campaign violation.
Of course not.
And it's outrageous that Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein would have authorized a plea guilty for a non-crime.
And the truth is, Mark, that there is no civil or criminal precedent to bring charges on something like this. Is that not correct?
There is. Look, the precedent was Edwards, and he both got off, and the FEC ruled that these payments were not properly campaign payments, and so all the donors were off the hook. Look, just think about it for a minute. One of them, he's accused of coordinating, not actually even making the payment. And imagine if Michael Avenatti coordinated a payment to Stormy Daniels with CBS to air it to help Hillary, then that would have to be a campaign contribution, just as a payment not to air it would be a campaign contribution.
Exactly.
All of these things, which is why the whole thing's absurd.
The whole thing is absurd, and in the end, you know, is Lady Justice, does she have it in for Donald Trump? And are there two systems of justice in this country? I'll ask both of you, 30 seconds.
That's what we're seeing. That's clearly what we're seeing. We're seeing a vendetta against the president of the United States because he won an election fair and square.
But you know what's interesting, Pam, and you and I have both been prosecutors. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we have to be believers. If we weren't believers, we wouldn't be doing the jobs that you're doing, that I did.
Right.
It's, you know, and it is so frustrating because this is not the way justice is supposed to work.
No, and especially when you see a guy like Michael Cohen, we all know he is a zero as a witness. He's useless. That guy
zero
is useless.
Zero as a witness and a lawyer.
Right. He's told so many different stories.
Yes.
So many stories.
Yes. Go ahead, Greg.
Partisans have ripped the blindfold off of Lady Justice.
Or she's looking through the bandages.
And they have jumped on the scales of justice. And yep. They have tipped it in their favor for political purposes. That is anathema to our rule of law and the system of justice.
So given that, don't you think that if we get no justice in our justice system, will we get justice in the 2018 elections? Quick, yes or no, Mark?
Well, look, I fought
yes
strongly
no.
for President Clinton.
That's not a yes or no.
Right? Look, we will get justice every time people vote
That's
instead
right.
of having
Pam,
our politicians locked with
yes.
prosecutors.
No way to know.
Good answer. Anyway, great panel. Thanks for being with us.
In this next clip coming up, we have Sean Hannity summarizing where things are at and trying to inject a little bit of urgency here in that the midterm elections are coming up in 71 days, and what would happen if the Democrats took over? And at the end of the tape, he has a collection of what echoes around in the echo chamber, and it's pretty frightening. Anyway, Sean Hannity on where it's at and some examples of what's echoing in the echo chamber, which I'll talk about more in a little bit.
I have been warning about this for a long time. If you don't believe it now, I don't know what will make you believe it. 76 days, you will decide if the president and his agenda goes forward, because they will stop that. This November, the future of this continued successful economic boom, continued peace through strength, all of this, a lot of stuff at stake. And sadly, that's not all. We know what the Democratic agenda is. It's pretty scary, actually. Let's see, what they called crumbs, your tax cuts, they want their crumbs back. And as we said, they want to impeach the president. As we've told you, they want to preserve Obamacare. Lose your doctor, lose your plan, pay more. That seems to work for them. They want to block Judge Kavanaugh and constitutionalists to the Supreme Court, originalists. They want open borders. They want to eliminate ICE. They're saying as much. They want to kill off all of these investigations, just drop it right there, for their deep state friends and this massive abuse of power that we have been able to expose. And as always, the mainstream media, the destroy Trump media, they're just doing the bidding of the left. The Democratic Party, they're an extension of their press office. And like a broken record, you know, for what seems like the millionth time, the crisis peddlers in the news media in this country, the echo chamber, they're all predicting the same thing, because it's what they're hoping for. Impeachment. This is what they've wanted for a long time. This is their shot. Take a look.
Given the events of today, the likelihood of impeachment, I'm not saying it's high necessarily, but it certainly went up.
Impeachment.
Impeached.
Impeachment.
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 The president is clearly guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. He should resign his office or be impeached.
Today, the Trump presidency took a giant step toward impeachment.
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 Impeachment implications are now in the air.
Impeachment.
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 If it is a crime, it certainly is an impeachable offense.
Impeach Trump.
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
Impeachment. Remember S-hole, S-hole, S-hole. Remember Stormy, Stormy, Stormy. Russia, Russia, Russia. They hyperventilate over whatever the issue is of the day. For over 24 hours, your apocalyptic press have been working overtime in overdrive, pushing anti-Trump conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory. We have the evidence. Take a look. You decide.
The man who once said he'd take a bullet for Donald Trump today in federal court was essentially calling his old boss and client, now the president of the United States, a crook.
So there are a lot of players now who start to potentially construct an enterprise, a criminal enterprise that is around or may even involve the president.
It's very baked in as of now and is not going to change that Donald Trump is indeed a scumbag. Voters know that.
I think there is something worse than a useful idiot, and that would be a useful idiot under legal siege. And that is what President Donald Trump is this morning.
You really want to stay home in 76 days? Did you vote for the president? You happy with the economy? You want to stay the course? You like the judges appointed? You want borders secured? Do you want health care transformed? Do you want peace through strength? But it's this kind of breathless, abusive bias. It's the very reason the president has rightly criticized the media, including this moment in his interview on Fox & Friends. It will air tomorrow morning with Ainsley. Take a look.
The press. Is the press the enemy of the people?
No, not at all. But the fake news is. And the fake news is comprised of, it's a lot, it's a big chunk, okay? Somebody said, what's the chunk? I said, 80%? It's a lot. It's a lot. If I do something well, it's not reported. Other than in the 20%. I mean, the New York Times cannot write a good story about me. They're crazed. They're like lunatics.
As you can see from tonight's monologue, I told you a long time ago, the very beginning, it actually started the day he and Melania came down the escalator. Five forces that have been working against the president, they're now more active. They sense there's blood in the water. They are literally harmoniously working together. And yeah, most of them would love the impeachment of the president you voted for and stop the progress, ruin his agenda. Now, this is real, and never has it been more important. If you care about your vote in 2016, you might want to register and vote, knowing that this hate, this destruction, this havoc that will occur if the Democrats take back the House, it's a clear and present danger. So don't tell me, by the way, the morning after the election, that you didn't have sufficient knowledge of what they would do. 76 days from today, you have a massive opportunity to protect your vote in 2016. Preserve that vote. Repair the system of justice. Make this country a better place for every American. There's a lot riding on this midterm. They want to undo the agenda you voted for. They want to stop the progress we have obviously made that they'll never talk about in the media. All right, before we wrap up our monologue tonight.
Okay, on to the mother of all echo chambers. You'll know what I mean later on in the broadcast here. But let's start with the definition of what is an echo chamber. In the news media, an echo chamber is a metaphorical description of a situation in which beliefs are amplified or reinforced by communication and repetition inside a closed system. In New Yorker magazine, August 23, 2018, Ronan Farrow and Adam Antoine. You remember Ronan Farrow from the Harvey Weinstein expose that led to the Me Too movement, published an article entitled The Conspiracy Memo About Obama AIDS that circulated in the Trump White House. And let me read a little bit from that article. In early 2017, some of Donald Trump's advisors concluded that they faced a sophisticated threat responsible for coordinated attacks on the new administration. They circulated a memo entitled The Echo Chamber, which read like a U.S. military intelligence officer's analysis of a foreign insurgent network. Instead of being about enemies in a distant war zone, however, the network described in the memo consisted of former aides to President Barack Obama. The memo claimed that the communications infrastructure that the Obama White House used to sell Obamacare and the Iran deal to the public had been moved to the private sector now that the former aides were out of the government. It called the network the Echo Chamber and accused its members of mounting a coordinated effort to undermine President Trump's foreign policy through organized attacks in the press against Trump and his advisors. They are the Obama loyalists who are probably among those coordinating the daily, weekly battle rhythm, the memo said, adding that they likely operated a virtual war room. The memo lists Ben Rhodes, a former deputy national security advisor to President Obama, as likely the brains behind the operation, and Colin Cowell, Vice President Joe Biden's former national security advisor, as its likely ops chief. Rose and Cowell both said in interviews that the allegations are false and no such organization exists. So who was Ben Rhodes? Is Ben Rhodes? Well, he's the brother of David Rhodes, who happens to be president of CBS News. And that's interesting because there was an Emmy-winning reporter named Cheryl Atkinson who worked at CBS News. And she got a little bit too deep into the Benghazi fiasco. And, Ben Rhodes calls brother David, and Atkinson is gone. Don't forget that Ben Rhodes was the one who pushed the false narrative about Benghazi video and trotted Susan Rice, his boss, to sell it. When he was at the White House, he was Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications under Susan Rice. Okay, let's go back a little bit into history. May 5th, 2016, there's a New York Times Sunday Magazine article entitled How Ben Rhodes Rewrote the Rules of Diplomacy for the Digital Age, written by somebody named David Samuels. And it was interesting when this first came out because a lot of people didn't quite know how to react to it because it appeared as though Ben Rhodes was explaining how he basically sold the Iran deal and basically most of it was fabricated by him. Anyway, let me read you some of this article and you'll see why people rolled their eyes and didn't know what exactly they were looking at. As a deputy national security advisor for strategic communications, Rhodes writes the president's speeches, plans his trips abroad, and runs communication strategies across the White House. Tasks taken individually give little sense of the importance of his role. He is, according to the consensus of the 24 current and former White House insiders I talked to, the single most influential voice shaping American foreign policy aside from POTUS himself. The president and Rhodes communicate regularly several times a day, according to Dennis McDonough, Obama's chief of staff, who is known for captaining a tight ship. I see it throughout the day in person, he says, adding that he is sure that in addition to the 2 or 3 hours that Rhodes might spend with Obama daily, the two men communicate remotely throughout the day via email and phone calls. Rhodes strategized and ran the successful Iran deal messaging campaign, helped negotiate the opening of the American relationship with Cuba after a hiatus of more than 50 years, and has been a co-author of all of Obama's major foreign policy speeches. Every day he does 12 jobs, and he does them better than the other people who have those jobs. Terry Suplot, the longest tenured member of the National Security Council speechwriting corps, told me. On the largest and smallest questions alike, the voice in which America speaks to the world is that of Ben Rhodes. Like Obama, Rhodes is a storyteller who uses a writer's tool to advance an agenda that is packaged as politics, but is often quite personal. He is adept at constructing overarching plot lines with heroes and villains, their conflicts and motivations supported by flurries of carefully chosen adjectives, quotations, and leaks from named and unnamed senior officials. He is the master shaper and retailer of Obama's foreign policy narratives at a time when the killer wave of social media has washed away the sandcastles of the traditional press. The ability to navigate and shape the new environment makes him a more effective and powerful extension of the president's will than any number of policy advisors or diplomats or spies. His lack of conventional real-world experience of the kind that normally precedes responsibility for the fate of nations, like military or diplomatic service, or even a master's degree in international relations, rather than creative writing, is still startling. Parts of what accounts for Rhodes' influence is his mind meld with the president. Nearly everyone I spoke to about Rhodes used the phrase mind meld verbatim. Some with casual assurance and others in the hushed tones that are usually reserved for special insights. He doesn't think for the president, but he knows what the president is thinking, which is a source of tremendous power. One day when Rhodes and I were sitting in his boiler room office, he confessed with a touch of bafflement, "I don't know anymore where I begin and Obama ends." Rhodes, during a video conference with the White House Situation Room, standing in his front office before the State of the Union, Rhodes quickly does the political math on the breaking Iran story. Quote, "Now they'll show scary pictures of people praying to the Supreme Leader," unquote, he predicts, looking at the screen. Three beats more and his brain has spun a storyline to stand, staunch the bleeding. He turns to Price, his assistant, says, "We're resolving this because we have relationships," he says. Price, who is Rhodes' assistant, turns to his computer and begins tapping away at the administration's well-cultivated network of officials, talking heads, columnists, and newspaper reporters, web jockeys, and outside advocates who can tweet at critics and tweak their stories, backed up by quotations from senior White House officials and spokespeople. I watched the message bounce from Rhodes' brain to Price's keyboard to the three big briefing podiums, the White House, the State Department, and the Pentagon, and across the Twitterverse, where it springs to life in dozens of Insta stories, which over the next 5 hours don formal dress for mainstream outlets. It's a tutorial in the making of a digital news microclimate, a storm that is easy to mistake these days for a fact of nature, but whose author is sitting next to me right now. Niels, the author of the piece, goes on. Having recently spent time working in Hollywood, I realized during our conversations that the role Rhodes plays in the White House bears less resemblance to any specific character on Beltway Insider TV shows like The West Wing or House of Cards than it does to the people who create these shows. And like most TV writers, Rhodes clearly prefers to imagine himself in the company of novelists. Further on down in the article, he talks about selling the Iran deal and Rhodes' innovative campaign to do so. Rhodes' innovative campaign to sell the Iran deal is likely to be a model for how future administrations explain foreign policy to Congress and the public. The way in which most Americans have heard the story of the Iran deal presented, that the Obama administration began seriously engaging with Iranian officials in 2013 in order to take advantage of a new political reality in Iran, which came about because of elections that brought moderates to power in that country, was largely manufactured for the purposes of selling the deal. In the narrative that Rhodes shaped the story of the Iran deal began in 2013 when a moderate faction inside the Iranian regime led by Hassan Rouhani beat regime hardliners in an election and then began to pursue a policy of openness, which included a newfound willingness to negotiate the dismantling of its illicit nuclear weapons program. The president set out the timeline himself in his speech announcing a nuclear deal on July 14, 2015. Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not, the president said. While the president's statement was technically accurate, there had in fact been 2 years of formal negotiations leading up to the signing of the JCPOA. It was also actively misleading because the most meaningful part of the negotiations with Iran had begun in mid-2012, many months before Rouhani and the moderate camp were chosen in an election among candidates handpicked by Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The idea that there was a new reality in Iran was politically useful to the Obama administration. By obtaining broad public currency for the thought that there was a significant split in the regime and that the administration was reaching out to the moderate-minded Iranians who wanted peaceful negotiations with their neighbors and with America, Obama was able to evade what might have otherwise been a divisive but clarifying debate over the actual policy choices that the administration was making. By eliminating the fuss about Iran's nuclear program, the administration hoped to eliminate a source of structural tension between the two countries, which would create the space for America to disentangle itself from its established system of alliances with countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Israel, and Turkey. With one bold move, the administration would effectively begin the process of a large-scale disengagement from the Middle East. So Ben Rose, the aspiring novelist, sold Obama's bizarre vision for the Middle East, and the deal was signed by the two leaders, but never by Congress. And in the long run, of course, Trump threw it out. But the Iranians managed to get $150 billion before it was canceled. So that's the power of one guy, one aspiring novelist sitting in the White House, mind-melding with President Obama. Frightening. Up next, we have Ben Rose himself commenting on the story of the document that was discovered. And, you know, notice how he talks about it as this wild deep state fantasy thing that everybody keeps talking about, like it doesn't exist. And, well, the scary part is a lot of Americans still believe that. There is no such thing as the deep state. But take a listen to how Ben Rose himself sees it.
President Trump regularly criticizes former President Barack Obama and members of his administration. Now we're getting a new look at how the Trump administration officials reportedly view their predecessors. The New Yorker obtained a memo reportedly circulated inside the White House in early 2017. It describes a group of Obama administration officials as the, quote, echo chamber. It accuses them of trying to undermine Trump's foreign policy. The memo said the group was led by former Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes and Colin Kahl, Vice President Biden's National Security Advisor. All of the people named in the memo held top jobs at the White House, National Security Council, or the State Department. Rhodes and Kahl denied the allegations and say that no such organization exists. Joining us now is Ben Rhodes, the alleged ringleader of the echo chamber, who is now an MSNBC political contributor. He's also the author of The World As It Is, a memoir of the Obama White House, which conveniently leaves out any reference to said echo chamber. Ben, what are you hiding?
Well, yeah, I'm coming to you from deep in a mountain somewhere, Ali, where I'm leading this effort. The concerning thing about this is this was written like a national security document, apparently emanating from the National Security Council.
That's right, a not serious document.
Yeah, and it's not supposed to be a political agency, the NSC. You're supposed to coordinate the government on foreign policy and national security. Politics is supposed to be out of that. So the fact of the matter that they had people sitting around spending their time, we're supposed to be protecting our country, keeping our country safe, instead concocting these bizarre conspiracy theories about a deep state network of people undermining them, you know, is concerning that that's what people are doing who are supposed to be protecting America, concerning that kind of conspiracy theory mindset is so deeply embedded inside the White House. We've seen it on other things. And frankly, it mirrors the type of investigation that we learned the firm Black Cube did into my family and Colin's family, you know, that raises questions about whether the Trump White House was behind hiring a foreign intelligence entity to dig up dirt on its predecessors. It's very bizarre.
So here's where the line becomes difficult to understand. You guys were all national security officials who worked for an administration, so there are things around which you may be like-minded, or things around which you came to be like-minded because you worked on particular policies. What's the line here? Is this the deep state argument? Is this the, since you all worked for Obama on national policy issues, this is the evidence that there's an, you know, what do you think it is? What's the point?
Well, this is what's strange about it. I mean, look, obviously, we all worked in the Obama White House. We all have our own views We all speak our mind when we leave the White House. That's clear, and people can see us doing that. Some of those friends of mine have a podcast, Pod Save America, a lot of people listen to. What's strange about this is it constructs this kind of deep state network where all we're doing, we're in touch with each other. We're, you know, brainwashing the media, essentially, around certain narratives. That potentially, we're working with people who are still in government to undermine Trump. This conspiracy theory type of mindset that sees normal opposition discourse as something much more nefarious, I think it connects directly to what we saw with John Brennan, for instance, where just people leaving government, speaking their mind, is somehow not welcome in this country. And frankly, that memo maps us out the same way that I read memos that mapped out terrorist organizations, right? So it's literally they're defining as an enemy of the American government normal dissent, and again, giving us much more agency than we have.
Right. Normal First Amendment dissent becomes a lot more nefarious when you start calling it a, when you start associating with the deep state.
Okay, in this last loop, you have an excerpt from the podcast that Ben Rose referred to. It's called Pod Save America. And on it, you have Jon Favreau, who's former Obama speechwriter, and Dan Pfeiffer, Obama, I believe, White House communications director. And listen to these guys talk and imagine those two guys and Ben Rhodes hanging around the White House for 8 years, talking, as they say, just the way they did when they were in the White House. And imagine these people running the country. Frightening. Have a listen.
So this week has been a real potpourri of stupid, but it all seems to lead back.
Just trying to get that episode title out. Quick.
I was trying to think of potpourri of what, and I just decided to go stupid. But it's all connected, all the news, because it seems to lead back to a president who's acting guilty as hell and is too dumb to cover up his crimes in any kind of believable way, except for the cult that is now most of the Republican Party. So let's start off where we left off on Tuesday's pod, which we recorded right before Omarosa released another secretly recorded conversation from the 2016 campaign, where she and her colleagues discussed how to prepare for the potential release of a tape where Trump used the N-word. On the recording, Trump spokesperson Katrina Pearson says, quote, "I am trying to find at least what context it was used to help us maybe try to figure out a way to spin it." Then later she says, "No, he said it. He is embarrassed by it." When asked about this at the White House briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said she couldn't guarantee there wasn't a recording of Trump using the N-word. Trump also tweeted that Apprentice creator Mark Burnett called to say that there are no tapes from the show where Trump says the N-word, which is like saying the bank called to say there's no video of me robbing it. Dan, do you think he said the word?
Yes. Yes, of course he has said the word. He is a 73-year-old angry white man with a obvious and long history of racist views. It seems incredibly likely he said it. And the tape, like, I never know what to think about these Omarosa tapes. I presume this is real. It is not clear whether they had heard a tape or they were told about the existence of a tape, but they seem to all be in agreement around one thing. Donald Trump had certainly said the N-word, and they're trying to figure out how to spin that fact. And just a little, there is no context. There is no context where that would be okay, unless Trump was saying, I mean, there's no context. It's just
no
the
context.
Whole thing. Yeah, the whole thing is absurd.
Yeah, we also saw, it's like ridiculous, the names in the news we have to talk about today. Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller said he was in the room when Trump said racially insensitive things during The Apprentice that it often made him uncomfortable. So again, it's like there is long documented history of Donald Trump saying racist things during the campaign, during his time in the White House, back when he was refusing to rent his apartments to African Americans and got sued for it. I mean, whether it's policies, whether it's actions, whether it's statements, whether it's words, over and over and over again, the one consistent thing in Donald Trump's life is that he has been racist time and again.
Yes, 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 yes. We do not need a tape to prove this. And it just, like, where everyone's sitting around just waiting for the other shoe to drop, and there are fucking shoes everywhere. We know this. And here are ways in which we know Donald Trump is racist. His policies are racist. His statements are racist. He has a long history of racist policies and views. And this is, I find to be the most damning, is that avowed public racists applaud Donald Trump for his racism. That is why they like him. It is why white supremacists, Pepe the Frog nerds, and these sad losers who wrap themselves in Nazism and white supremacy love Donald Trump, because these are people who are connoisseurs of racist views. And they love Donald Trump because based on what they see of Donald Trump, he agrees with their views. It is open and shut case. It's not even, like, we don't need proof. We have proof. We don't need some smoking gun tape to tell us that something we already know with our eyes. It is the same thing with collusion. It is the same thing with everything about Donald Trump. All of the crimes, the corruption, the racism is happening right before our eyes. Yet, as a political culture, the media, other politicians, we are constantly looking for some sort of holy grail of evidence to prove to us what we already know. And we do this because it is easier for the media, it is easier for other Republican politicians to always be waiting for the next thing before they have to take a moral stand on what is happening in our country.
Right. And you can argue, and I would, that past Republican presidents and other Republican politicians have certainly used and employed racial dog whistles. You can argue that Republican policies have increased racial inequities in this country, that they have just led to discrimination against African Americans, certainly. But those racists that you're talking about, the white supremacists, the David Dukes, all these people who are, you know, white supremacists, white nationalists, they didn't praise George W. Bush. They didn't praise Mitt Romney. They didn't praise John McCain. They didn't praise a lot of other leaders of the Republican Party. They praise Donald Trump because they know that Donald Trump's views are in line with their views, more so than any Republican in their lifetime, probably, who's risen to that level of power.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, I mean, Trump responds to Omarosa's allegations that he used a racial slur by calling her a dog and a lowlife. So if you're wondering if he's going to use racially insensitive comments, and of course, you know, all the fucking MAGA people are online yesterday, and, you know, the big job for the last couple of days was to defend Donald Trump by saying he's called white people dogs as well. So obviously that's not racially loaded. Yeah, okay. Go with that defense. Yeah. That'll work for you.
When your defense is he's an asshole to everyone, not just certain people, then you have lost the debate. And also, like, because we live in a world of data journalism, people actually analyze the claim, and overwhelmingly, he calls African Americans stupid and dogs. And then I would note one other thing. I'm pretty fired up this morning because I had like 18 coffees to try to get ready for this.
Nice.
Is I can't remember which story it was that said that Donald Trump has often used the term dog because he believes that canine comparisons are the most devastating of insults.
Because he hates dogs, and that's why he doesn't have a pet. So, Dan, let's say a tape comes out tomorrow, or maybe today, and when Omarosa reveals one on MSNBC, where Trump is saying the N-word. What do you think the political impact would be?
I think in the short term, it would be devastating in the sense that Trump would go through one of those periods like after he praised the Nazis as being fine people, where everyone would get upset, Republicans would send out, even Republicans who were not named Jeff Flake and Bob Corker would send out sad tweets decrying the use of the N-word without even mentioning Trump. And the press would be in a feeding frenzy just because, as we've seen in sort of our social media, digital media world, when there are videos or audio recordings that can be shared, it just becomes a much bigger deal. That is a large reason as to why people became so focused around the child separation policy in the media. Not just because it's a moral travesty and a policy atrocity, but because there were images to go with the story. Because we live in an image-centric world. But I don't know that anything fundamentally changes, like, because what really matters is the balance of power and how people use it. Would that cause two Republican senators to walk across the aisle and caucus with the Democrats, giving the gavel to Chuck Schumer? No. Would that cause Republicans to run away from Trump? No. Would it cause Paul Ryan to spend the next 5 months trying not listening to that tape? Yes.
I actually agree with our friend Brian Boitler, who wrote a piece about this for Crooked, that it would have a bigger political impact than we might think. And I think the reason is you and I, a lot of people who listen to this podcast, you know, would define racism in a very broad sense, and I would argue accurately, you know, and we would define it as policies that, you know, racial policies, Trump's immigration policies, saying things like shithole country, calling an African-American woman a dog, calling Maxine Waters stupid, all basically, you know, saying that a Mexican judge can't give you a fair hearing because he's Mexican. Like, we would say all these things are obviously racist. But I still think there's a lot of people in this country who think that racism, they don't see structural racism as much. And when they think racism, they only think of, you know, either violence or assault against or outright discrimination against African Americans and people of color and using that word, right? Now, I would argue that's a very narrow view of what racism really is, but I do think that's what a lot of people think racism is. Some people who, you know, don't pay as close attention to politics and news and all that kind of stuff. And I think that an audio tape out there of the President of the United States using that word would actually jar the country in a way, and Brian argues this in his piece, in a way that the Access Hollywood tape sort of jarred the country. And look, he won after the Access Hollywood tape, which is the whole fucking thing that drives us crazy. But we forget that it did sort of, you know, I mean, his poll numbers fell into the 30s there. And had the election been held a week after the Access Hollywood tape, I'm pretty confident that Hillary Clinton would have won.
Yeah, I think that's the point, though, right? And this is where I agree with you. I think it would be a huge deal when it happened. It would require the entire political system to react. The press would cover it rightfully as one of the biggest deals in modern political history. I think Republicans would be on the campaign trail in Capitol Hill, be forced to.
So there you have it, the fourth estate portion of the deep state, and you hear them saying that they don't really exist. I believe there's overwhelming evidence that they do exist and that they're plotting a coup to basically, at this point, impeach the president. So stay tuned because things are going to pick up. The elections are coming and the Mueller investigation is winding down and either they're right or we're right. So tune in to this podcast as opposed to Pod Save America to find out what's really going on.